Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Sean Dugan of the Alaska Dispatch. Paul, some assembly members, perhaps the majority, want to change the date on which the initiative to roll back the Sullivan labor laws would appear before the voters. Instead of next April's municipal election, the assembly members are thinking, well, maybe the state election next year, the state election in the fall of 2014, or the spring election in which we elect a mayor in 2015. Explain, Paul, what the assembly members have in mind.
I don't know. I think they've bit off more than they could chew with AO 37. The union objected to the passage of the measure and immediately went to collect signatures. It collected 22,000 signatures to repeal the ordinance when it only needed 7,000. The city said, no, you can't do all of that because it's an administrative change and you can't do it by referendum. So now it's on its way to the Supreme Court on the legal avenue. As far as the petitions go and the election goes, well, the charter says you have to have that election, when they've won the election, they have to have that election soon or sometime. And nobody knows when sometime is. They forgot to say in the charter when the next election, they don't say the next election. They just say an upcoming election, I think. There's no specific time frame.
Well, it's not obvious what people's motives are, but on the other hand, usually people who want to, okay, I'll leave it. So much for being even-handed. I won't try that again.
Okay, Paul, Jennifer Johnston, assemblywoman, decided, well, what she would do is try to delay the election until 2014. There was another move to 2015. The idea, they say, is to increase voter turnout instead of having a special election or a close election when nobody would turn out. Let's have everybody turn out. 2014 is going to be some very contentious elections in the state. Everybody's going to turn out. 2015, and also mix into all of this, well, you have now Mayor Sullivan running for lieutenant governor in 2014. Is that a good time to do it when all the anti-labor forces will come out? Do we wait till 2015 and dump, get an assembly and a mayor that's pro-labor? Or what do we do? So anyway, that's where they're at now. This is all very, very political, and really, this is how it works.
Steve, the unions and their allies on the other side, they came back with strong objections, to say the least.
Well, first of all, the response was, what? Because I think it caught everybody by surprise. Paul Honeyman, who was the assembly member who was against AO 37, said he didn't know they could do that, so he was a little surprised by the whole thing. And the union folks all thought it was, you know, that can't be. So they all went running, as Paul said, looking at the charter. So yeah, they're pretty upset about this whole thing, and they point to the fact that AO 37 from the get-go has been pretty carefully orchestrated. The mayor introduced the proposed ordinance on the last day that anybody could file for the assembly election. He had Cheryl Fresca appointed to the West Anchorage assembly seat. Harriet Drummond had gone to the legislature. She won a seat in the legislature. So that Cheryl very close ally with Dan Sullivan. So it sounded like he kind of had everything lined up. You know, he's a politician. He knows he can count votes. And then they cut off the people who were wanting to talk about it, the debate. They cut off the debate, and then that started the big firestorm. So they're really angry. I think that the unions feel that, you know, they're on a roll. They were still able to get quite a bit of their supporters out in that April 2013 election. They nearly knocked off
Ernie Hall.
I don't think Dick Traney would have won that midtown election had it not been for what had happened. They got another candidate there. It was a Tim Steele in West Anchorage elected. So the union, I think, has some momentum going right now. I think they're feeling their muscle, and I think on April 2014, that election would all be about who's got the momentum, who's got the motivation, and who can get their supporters out to the polls. And right now, it would look like the unions have the apparatus in place and the the motivation to get that done. So,
Steve, let's stick with you for a couple minutes more. The Anchorage Muni is attempting to obtain more than 130 acres of surplus federal land near the airport and Kincaid Park. They want to turn it into a complex for homeless people and also where homeless people can get treatment.
Yeah, it's something that the city is in need of. You've got Brother Francis Shelter, but that is just a temporary living place, and it really isn't able to transition people off the streets and into affordable housing, which in our town, there's very little affordable housing right now. So the mayor sees this land as a place where they can build a campus, their term, that would help people get into affordable housing, get off the street. It would also be for people who are maybe on the verge of losing their homes. So they would be able to go into this complex as well. There would also be substance abuse treatment to help people get over addictions, things like that. The land would come free. The federal government is disposing of its excess land. So this is land that's next to Kincaid Park and across from the airport, and they would build these facilities. The land has also been applied. There's also a competitor in all of this, and that's the Department of Transportation. The state wants it to use that 130 acres to expand the airport and use it as a buffer as well. The problem that's probably going to come up here, obviously, is this happened in pretty rapid succession. Residents haven't really been brought up to speed about this. So the city is planning some meetings, some town hall discussions coming up next month. The mayor was supposed to meet with the head of the Sand Lake Community Council yesterday. He has some questions about this. You know, how are people going to be wandering off the campus and into the neighborhoods? Are they going to be wandering into Kincaid Park? It's a concern. So it is a treatment facility and a place that's badly needed in Anchorage. And we'll see how people how well they
and it would be surprising folks. If there wasn't a certain amount of controversy that certainly is in every past dealing with homeless people here.
There always has been.
Sean, former Republican Senate nominee Joe Miller has had his innings with the Alaska Dispatch. First, it was over up to the Dispatch's attempt to obtain his employment records in Fairbanks. Then a long court case. Then a judgment against Miller, which he still hasn't paid. Now he's unhappy with content of the Dispatch.
Yeah, well, let's not also forget that he handcuffed our editor, Tony Huffinger, as well.
I left out the most important thing.
Add that to the list.
Arrested him, you mean?
Well, yeah, tried to affect his citizen's arrest.
That. Come on.
Yeah. Well, so what happened yesterday is on Facebook, you know, everybody uses Facebook these days for a variety of things, mainly to draw attention to things. And Joe Miller, who has his personal page public, meaning all his posts can be seen by anybody who's on the newsfeed, had forwarded a post from his daughter, who's raising money for herself and her family. And so
In Mexico.
She and her husband are missionaries for a very well-respected Christian organization, and they're down there. I think they're building houses for people and other things, but they don't draw a salary. They rely on God's providence, and they rely on the goodwill of others to pay for things. And so they're seeking to raise $10,000 by December to pay for the birth of their baby, some of the paperwork that will come along with making it a dual citizen, and then also money for a new car that will handle the family, the dog, and the husband's surfboards. And so we put that up. It was a public blog. Her blog was a public blog. And it was
a public asking for money.
It was. And it was noted that Joe Miller, you know, last time around ran on a platform of personal responsibility, among other things. And so I think it was a fair question to ask. And today on Joe Miller's website, Restoring Liberty, he has a very, you know, pointed article about our efforts yesterday and asking people to call the Dispatch and asking for an apology. So it continues. I'm sure it will continue. Things will probably only get worse as the election season.
He is a candidate for the Senate again, and somehow this all plays into his candidacy, no doubt. We're going to stick again with you, Sean. An EPA team goes to Chicken. That's the town in the 40-mile country, armed, apparently looking for water quality violators. Whatever the government's intent, the response from the Alaska Congressional Delegation, Sean Parnell, and the miners of that region itself has been very angry. Sean, you and Sean Parnell were both in Chicken, and you got to watch the governor hear from these folks and a representative of the EPA. What did you hear and see?
Well, what I saw was a lot of angry miners who were very cordial to the EPA man. He's Ken Fisher. He's the deputy director for Alaska. He was not involved with the decision to send what was the Alaska Environmental Crimes Task Force, which was run by the EPA but consisted of members of BLM. They went in August 22nd. They went into 30 mines in the Chicken area, and it was an enforcement task force, so it wasn't like what they're used to in that area, which is a guy showing up with a clipboard and a vial saying,
"I'm going to ask you about water quality."
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and they're looking for people that are dumping muddy water into the 40 Mile, which is a national scenic river controlled. 32 miles of that's controlled by the feds, and so the miners took exception with the way they were treated. Guys came by in body armor with police blazers. They didn't stop to talk to anybody. They went straight for the sluice box. The miners felt like they were being treated in a heavy-handed manner. The EPA, for its part, has said, oh, no, we had reasons for everything we did. One of the reasons they gave the congressional delegation after they started digging into it was that there was rampant and ongoing human and drug trafficking in the area.
The idea of rampant human trafficking in that region,
and chicken.
You can go days without seeing anybody.
Yeah, chicken is, for those of you who may not know, it's, 66 miles up the Taylor Highway, which is 10 miles out of Tok. You have to want to get to Chicken. It's not a big tourist destination, although it is on the way to Eagle and Dawson City.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the governor flew in. It was unexpected that he would attend. He had several questions for the EPA man himself, but you know, in fairness, the Ken Fisher knew very little about what had happened. He had been briefed in Juneau and asked to show up at the meeting. So there still remains a lot of unanswered questions, such as if the violations were so egregious that people needed to visit.
How does this get resolved?
I don't know. The EPA isn't answering questions on this anymore. The governor's called for a special counsel to investigate. He's also upset the DEC, the state agency, sent along an armed officer. I don't know what is happening with that, but I do know that he's asked for a special counsel to look into it. For the EPA's part, they aren't talking. They said that there will be charges in the future. There have been none. If it was that bad, you figure they should have shut somebody down. They didn't.
And you kind of wonder what the charges are going to be, human trafficking or water quality violations.
Well, they're supposedly violations of Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. So.
Paul, the Pew Charitable Trust, that large independent nonprofit, has issued a lengthy report on the challenges associated with oil development in the Arctic. What did Pew find, and what are the implications?
It's also a very well-respected trust, I might point out.
Yeah.
This report is part of the Interior Department's public process that began in June. It's planning to update its regulations by the end of this year. After, I guess, Shell's problems last year, it decided that its regulations might need another look, what its requirements are, that sort of thing. The Pew Trust said that diminishing sea ice is presenting new challenges and problems up there, and that current technology is unproved, and that the regulations now in place were not written for the Arctic. I think a lot of that's probably true. A lot of these regulations were written for other regions other than the Arctic. They're calling for things like, to me, some of it seems very
self-evident?
Yeah, seaworthy, ice-worthy ships, spill control equipment located nearby, redundant systems, oil rigs and vessels that are actually ice-worthy that can stand up to the rigors of the Arctic, and increased standards for expertise and experience. I think that it'll have quite an impact. The public process in this thing is going to be very extensive. The report will just simply be a part of that. But I think what they're saying is what a lot of people are saying, and that will have an impact over the long haul.
Okay. Let's go back to Sean. Nome, like so many Alaska communities, is bedeviled by high energy costs. People in Nome pay about 2.5 times what Anchorage customers pay now for energy. Scientists and drillers, however, are searching for a solution, and they're thinking about geothermal. Sean described as what's happening, starting with the history lesson. Mm-hmm. It's been well known that there are geothermal opportunities in that part of Alaska that have been known for a long time.
There have been. Pilgrim Hot Springs is there. It's actually 60 miles north, I believe, east of Nome. The hot springs have been around, for hundreds of years. It began in the turn of the century as a miners' camp. It was deeded to the church by the former owner in 1917. He was going to become a missionary for people away from the rowdiness of the gold rush Nome. And after the Spanish flu hit, it became an orphanage, basically. They've looked at it many times over the past. It's never penciled out, but with the rising cost of diesel, and you know, Nome had a problem getting diesel. Was it a winter or two winters ago? They had to contract a Russian ice-breaking tanker.
It was quite an event.
Yeah, to bring them fuel. They really want to kind of get off the cyclical up and down of diesel fuel, which is their main source of power. They do have 4 megawatts of wind that they're still kind of trying to dial in. But in looking at the work on Encina Hot Springs with their geothermal plant, they believe they've got the cost down to about potentially 22 cents a kilowatt hour, which is about what Nome Joint Utility might agree to pay. So it's coming very close to potentially coming online. They're currently drilling to see if they can have enough hot water to produce 2 megawatts of power. That combined with wind, 4 megawatts of wind, 2 of geothermal, would handle almost all of Nome's needs. I think the peak load in the winter goes up to 6.5 megawatts, so they'd still have to have diesel online, but it certainly would make things more reliable. And
what is the
cheaper.
Heart of this cost structure? What does it really require for the utility to buy this kind of energy?
Yeah, the utility doesn't want to pay more for renewables than they pay for diesel. And right now they're generating power with diesel at about 18 to 22 cents a gallon. It's constantly going up because the price of diesel went up. They just got their last barge in, and I think they paid $3.60 a gallon for diesel this year, and they paid $3.20, $3.30 last year. So the price seems to be going up. So
that's
kind of a bet.
That's as an industrial consumer. That's not what the individual.
Right. They're buying 1.5 million gallons at a time. So it's kind of a bet on the fact that diesel will continue to rise. And then, you know, of course, after the initial expense of building the geothermal plant and the power lines, which are the most expensive part, I think $30 million of the total $40 million
right.
project cost of power lines. After that, the price for producing power geothermally goes down. Basically, you pay off the debts and then you keep the thing running, and it gets pretty cheap. So it might become the first real commercial geothermal plant in Alaska for
okay, let's hope
large
so.
Scale.
Steve McDonald, the Fairbanks Four, you covered this story, the Hartman murder, and you have covered this story since quite a while. The murder actually took place in 97. Mm-hmm. Now the Innocence Project reports a California inmate serving a life sentence has confessed to this terrible killing.
Yeah, this was a big development. This was a big story that hit the Fairbanks area on Wednesday. The Innocence Project's been representing the Fairbanks Four essentially since 2008. The Tanana Chiefs Conference and a number of the people who support the Fairbanks Four and have felt that they are innocent of this crime pushed for the Innocence Project to take up this cause, and Bill Oberle, who's the executive director of the Innocence Project, agreed to do this in 2008. So since then, he's been following leads, doing investigative work, and a number of names keep popping up throughout these investigations, and finally, he gets 3 that keep coming up more often than not. There's a fellow who is in prison on a murder charge down in Spring Creek. They contacted him. He said didn't want to talk to any investigators. They went to another fellow who's serving a murder term in Oregon, who they kept hearing his name pop up. He didn't want to speak to authorities. Finally, they actually had Marvin Roberts, who's one of the people charged in the Hartman
murder. He's in prison.
He wrote a letter to this fellow named William Holmes in California and just said, you know, I'm in prison. Do you know anything about this thing? Holmes never answered. It took a while, and then just a two-line letter came to Bill Oberle saying, I'm William Holmes. You want to talk to me? I have some information. Send me your phone number. So that started things up. Holmes provided an affidavit that basically said that he and 4 of his friends were the ones who were driving around that night in Fairbanks on October 11, 1997. They were cruising, looking for what he called fun, which was basically looking for inebriated Alaska natives that he says in his affidavit. Found none. They would attack these folks. They spotted this, as he said, white boy walking down the street near Airport Way. Sean, you're familiar with the Fairbanks area. 4 of their guys jumped out of the car, according to what Holmes says, and attacked him. One of the 4 stomped on Hartman, and he died of blunt force trauma. So William Holmes is saying, admitting in a sworn affidavit, that he and these four others committed this crime.
Now, we know, Steve, that inmates are notorious liars. At the same time, there is somebody who's familiar with this crime who says that Holmes told him quite long ago that he was involved in this.
That's right.
Well, this person is another inmate too, I believe.
Right. Well, these guys were like five, they went to Lathrop High School.
My high school.
Your high school, yes, alma mater, Michael. There was a fellow by the name of, I can't think of his name.
Wallace,
thank you, Michael. Jason Wallace, who went to a fella, and they were in a car together, and he's with a guy named Scott Davison. And Davison says that Wallace described the night to him, a few nights after Hartman was killed and the Fairbanks Four were arrested. So Davison says that Wallace said, "We did this." Davison's had no response to us. He was really stunned by it, but he kept this information to himself for these 16 years. So his name kept popping up in the investigation. They went to him. He has a sworn affidavit telling everybody, saying what Wallace told him.
And quickly, here, the state of Alaska says we're going to look into it, but it would seem to be they should be under some moral pressure, at least internally, if not from the public, to move on this. These people have been in jail 16 years.
Right, and they will. They say that they will. The Department of Law told me yesterday that they will be looking at this. They are allotted 45 days to make a decision on this motion. The thing of it is that they say, Mr. Oberle took a year to corroborate all the things that Holmes told him in this letter last year. So they said, we may need more time than the 45 days. And Bill Oberle expects this, that the last for an extension. One of the things that the Department of Law points out, that these four fellows, the Fairbanks Four, were convicted by three different juries. So he says that's pretty credible evidence that convinced four separate
juries. It should be a
juries.
Serious matter to overthrow a conviction. And there's a question here if there may be some forensic evidence. I wanted to get into one other thing real quickly, and that is just, Sean, this morning we picked up the paper, and here, or the Dispatch if we looked online, or the Daily News if we went online, or Channel 2.
If you turned on the TV.
Yes. Yeah. Your media had a story of a murder that is in some ways similar.
Very reminiscent of
four young men in a sort of wilding incident, killing a helpless, defensive older man, just bludgeoning him to death.
Right.
So, I mean, you sort of wonder how many of these people are there.
Well, in Alaska, we like to think that we're far removed from that. But in fact, we see our fair share of that, too. I believe you're talking about the gentleman that was killed outside the mental health trust building. Yeah, apparently they took a street barricade and beat him with it and basically killed him. I don't know what you can take away from things like this other than these people are amongst us. They're in society. I suspect they've always been here. I suspect, unfortunately, they will always be here.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was talking to Frank Gurjevic, the editorial page editor of the Daily News today, and I sort of wondered to him what you could say about this. And Frank reminded me that what editorial pages can do in their capacity is express the moral outrage of the community. Yeah. Deplore murder, yes, but we need more than that. Paul, federal judge Sharon Gleason of Anchorage dismisses the Parnell administration's suit challenging stringent EPA rules that require cargo ships and cruise vessels to use low sulfur fuel within 200 miles of Alaska and Canada. What happened?
The state had challenged the North American Emissions Control Area, which requires use of low sulfur fuel. And all of that is basically an amendment, if you will, to the International Convention for the Prevention of Pollution from Ships, or MARPOL for short. It's an international treaty. The state, MARPOL, and this North American Emission Control Area, is very expensive for shippers and for tourist boats, because much of the time vessels here don't get 200 miles offshore. They're run within that, all up and down the coast. If you're leaving San Francisco going to China, you can switch to the cheaper fuel at 200 miles. You can't do that in Alaska. So they sued. And they were joined by the Resources Defense Council. And essentially, they said, look, this is an amendment to a treaty. The Senate didn't vote on it. Therefore, it's not valid. And the judge said, well, the Senate must have known that such things would happen. and we're signatories to this treaty, so get out of the way.
And they can appeal it to the Ninth Circuit?
They're examining an appeal now.
Okay. Sean, a large group of walruses haul out near Point Lay. Why is this news in Anchorage?
You know, I wondered too, because walruses are known to haul out, especially females with young calves, I believe they are, with walruses. The reason it's news is because they don't normally haul out in Point Lay. They have since 2007. They normally hang out in an area about 100 miles offshore, the Hannah Shoal, which is where they feed, and they use the ice floes to kind of rest. Walruses apparently aren't good swimmers because they're so dense that they don't float well.
Physically so, dense. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. They got a lot of mass.
Yeah.
I'm going to get some calls from the walrus moms. But so the walruses don't have enough sea ice out there at the Hannah Shoals to rest on. They bring their calves. It's mostly females and calves. They bring them over to Point Lay, where they've been doing this since 2007. I think there's one year they didn't. They're there because they can hunt offshore and then come to rest. So it's kind of one more indicator of a loss of sea ice. But they're saying that this could beat the 2010 record when there were 40 million pounds of walrus blubber hauled out there. And this is a mile and a half from shore. Difficult
it
to count them.
It must be an incredible sight.
It is. It's difficult to count them because the last thing you want to do with a large group of walruses is scare them because they tend to trample the young. So they're kind of leaving them there.
We've counted our last walrus for this week. So I'll be gone next week, but Lori Townsend and her crew will be here, right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.